Hi there, everybody. Welcome to The Principal Entrepreneur. I'm your host and author of the upcoming book, How to Be a Great Principal, Jonathan Royce. This is episode 74 of The Principal Entrepreneur, where we support educational leaders with strategies and suggestions that answer the question, how do I become a great principal? I also interview principals, school, and educational leaders just like me and you and discuss their areas of expertise and how they overcome the challenges within schools. In today's episode, we're talking with elementary principal, school turnaround expert, and CEO of CNC Educational Consulting, Mr. Sean Hurt. Before we get into his area of expertise, we'll dive into his origin story. Mr. Hurt, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan. Thank you for having me. I'm just excited being on the show on this sunny afternoon.
Yes, it is beautiful outside, and it is hot in here. Like I said, we're going to talk about your area of expertise and some of the steps that we can take to improve and turn around our schools in just a few minutes. But before we do that, how did you get into education in the first place?
Well, just when I graduated from college, I was able to work as a teacher and also a staff assistant in the Oak Park School District. And that intrigued me a lot because the principal at the time, he kind of took me under his wings and said, Sean, you're going to be a principal one day. And this was when I was, I think, 22 years old at the time. So from there, everything kind of panned out, and then I was able to learn a lot, grow, get some really good practices from some excellent teachers, and just from there, just went up the ladder, and currently I'm a principal, so I'm excited about that. And also, the other thing is that when I was in college, my supervisor at college, you know, she was my, she chose my, when I was trying to choose my major, she said, hey, I see that you work good with kids. I see that you really enjoy what you're doing. And then from there, that's when I saw that I had a passion to become an educator.
So growing up, like in high school, did you think about becoming an educator? What was kind of the spark that kind of got you even to think about being a teacher? Because for me, when I was in high school, that was really the last thing on my mind.
Yes, I think growing up in high school, I was really interested in business. I wanted to just make a whole bunch of money. So that in high school, that was my focus. But what happened was that my junior year in college, I got a summer job working at a daycare. And then I just wanted just to work to put some money in my pocket. And then after the summer was over with, the owner of the daycare said, Sean, you have a special gift for working with kids. I see how you're dedicated. I see how you just really love them and you want the best for them. You should really look into becoming a teacher. Well, I'm 19 years old at the time. I just thought that she was just saying something just to make a young fella from the inner city feel good. And then, but that stuck with me. So as I went back to college my junior year, I changed my major, and then the other confirmation, like I said, was that my advisor said, hey, I see you around the campus, I see that you're a people's person, I see that you're very good with, you know, working with a group of people, you should look at becoming a teacher. And then, so after the second confirmation, and then from there, it kind of just took off.
Right, right. I had a somewhat similar instance growing up. I was still in college, and I did the whole, you know, biddy basketball, you know, coach of little kids, and then I was worked for the city as a rec ed counselor, and that was my first taste of, you know, kind of working with kids under a structured environment, and, you know, something that I really took to. And before that, you know, it wasn't even on my radar as something that I would even consider doing. So there's some similarities there where you just kind of, you don't even know how you get there, but you get there.
Yes, exactly.
So you've been an elementary principal. What's one of the biggest challenges in your experience, and how did you overcome that?
I think the biggest challenge for me is I am an out-of-the-box thinker. So early on in my principalship, I knew that what was being delivered from principals and teachers was not working for inner-city kids. So after my first year, I said, no, I'm going to scrap what I learned. I'm going to scrap what I've seen for the last 20, 25 years, and I'm going to do something totally out of the box. I'm going to do something that's going to really just improve inner-city education. So my first year, there were a lot of people who kind of doubted what we were going to do, and then also my staff and my teachers. And then at the end of the year, when we had tremendous growth, that's when people finally realized that, wow, inner-city kids can learn, but they just have to be taught in a totally different manner than maybe kids from other different types of situations.
So what was the difference between what you had been taught and then what your gut instinct was telling you?
Well, as I was looking at it and I was looking at the data, I said, wow, you know, for the last 20, 30 years, 40 years, a lot of inner city schools have been has been failing kids. It's pretty much kids have not been learning. They have not been prepared for high school, college, or even for the real world. So I said, okay, if I do this the same way, I'm going to have the same results.
Right.
So then when so my first year, I was an assistant principal of a high school. And then the principal said, you must improve the ACT score. So I took all of the juniors and I said, we're going to just study hard, we're going to work, do some different things. And the ACT scores went up from a 13 to a 15. And then the next year I became a principal of a school. It was a K-8 grade school. It was about 450 kids. And then we had some of the lowest achievement scores in 1 year to some of the highest, 1.5 years growth in math, reading. And we just pretty much study how inner city kids learn, a lot of hands-on projects taking place in the classroom, and we use data. I trained my teachers how to use data to really drive the instruction. So we hung our hats on those two things, and I've been doing that for the rest of my years now, and that's how I've been able to improve inner-city schools across the board.
So how did you talked about some of the resistance from the staff. What did you do to get them on board to your new ideas?
Well, I think the first thing that I always do, the first thing I did was I had to put the data up and let everyone understand. We call it deal with the elephant in the room or the brutal truth. This is the brutal truth. So the data was all of the speaker. So after I showed the data, then I said, we're going to set goals. We're going to set goals, smart goals that we can achieve at the end of the year. And then from there, I said, these are the steps that we're going to put in place to be able to achieve our goals. We're going to train all of the teachers in culturally responsive teaching. We're going to make sure that we have small learning communities in the classroom. We're going to always look at data every week to be able to drive our instruction. We're also going to involve the parents in the community, and they're going to understand why we do what we do, and we're going to get input from there. And then it's going to be collective effort from everybody. So from there, once we put that in place, we just saw the needle moving, and kids were learning. Our discipline went down. We didn't have a lot of kids being suspended, and also our special education rate went down also. We didn't put kids in the special education. We really did a tier two model where we really responded to intervention in the classroom, and then it just kind of took off from there.
That sounds fantastic. One of the struggles that I've seen is just getting teachers to look at that data and then trying to figure out what it even means. Did you have a background? Is that from your business background that you were able to not be afraid of that data, I guess?
Well, it really came, to be honest with you, from the sports arena. If you follow sports, any sports, whether it's basketball, football, hockey, baseball, everything is data, whether it's wins or losses, whether it's the averages, touchdown score, everything is data. So I said, man, if in sports or even in the business arena, if they use data to make any type of determination on how they're going to go about their business, why aren't schools doing that? So once again, when I first got into education, I just always wondered, why are we using data to really make these tough decisions? So then from there, I just kind of looked at it, and then I said, man, the schools that are really doing good across the United States, even globally, they always use data to drive their instruction. Everything is data-driven. So I said, if it's good for these top top schools, if it's good for these top universities, well, how about I use it at my elementary and middle school? So once I saw that, then I was able to get trained. I trained myself on how to look at data, interpret it, and then being able to train my teachers. That's how I kind of took it from there. So if you go to any of my schools, the only thing you see is charts, data discussions. Everything we do is just evolved around data.
Did that turn into a system that you now use systematically when you're changing schools?
Yeah, so it kind of turned into a system. So the first couple of years, we were just using it to kind of drive the instruction, and we would talk about it. And then after my third year, we were seeing our student achievement just soar through the roof. And then everybody was asking me, principals around the area and other districts, was asking me, well, how did you do this? And then we said, well, we just use data. So as the time went on, it went from just in the classroom to in the hallways. And it went from in the hallways to all through the building. And it went from all through the building to deliver what our SMART goals are going to be like. And then now all of my students will walk around and tell you, these are my data goals. This is what I have to achieve.
Right.
These are my strengths. These are my weaknesses and everything else.
If you were going to boil that whole experience down over those years, what's the single greatest takeaway from that experience and overcoming those challenges?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that we have to have high expectations for the students. And a lot of times we lower our expectations because we feel that they come from situations that might not be conducive to learning. That's something that you should never do. The kids that come from negative situations at home need to have a positive environment, high expectations at the school. And when you raise the bar, when you raise the expectations, the kids will meet those expectations. Many schools, what they do is they lower the bar, lower the expectations, and that's where the kids meet them at.
Yeah, the problem is usually with adults and less with the kids.
Yes, exactly. That's something that I tell all of my teachers. I say, we're not going to deal with the kids. It's not about a kids thing because kids are kids. We're going to deal with our mindset, how we view these kids, how we look at these kids, and how we're going to deliver the instruction every day for 180 days. I call it, we get into beast mode for 180 days. Once those kids come in, our teachers, we just go to a whole other level of how we're delivering this instruction, and we're just seeing results through the roof. Like this year, my kindergartens on a national test called the MAP NWEA test, they scored at the 98th percentile nationwide in math and reading.
Congratulations.
Inner city kids.
That is, congratulations, man. That's
Thank
some
you.
Hard work for your staff right there. So you're an expert in turning schools around. You've done it multiple times. You present all over and you consult with districts around the subjects. What are some of the most common things that you see that schools should be improving on or that if they just tweak this here and this that there, they would see some improvement?
A lot of times when I talk to principals and also when I talk to teachers, the first thing I tell them is they must have high expectations for their students. And second, I said that you must understand very clearly how inner city kids learn. So it's not how it was 30, 40 years ago. You must have different strategies in the classroom to reach these particular students. So that's something that I talk to my teachers and principals about. And the ones that really grasp it, the ones that really embrace it, they go back to their school districts, and they just you see just tremendous growth inside of their classroom and also at the school. Yesterday morning I was doing a training with a principal for about 4 hours, and he came to my school and he saw it, and then I could just see the twinkle in his eyes when he said, "Now I get it, Mr. Turner. Now I get what you were saying at the professional development regarding high expectations regarding teachers working at a depth of knowledge 3 or 4. I get it." And he said, and then this morning he said he just was a different principal just by being in my school and talking to me for those 3 hours and seeing what I was talking about at a professional development.
So one of the things that you mentioned that you talk about in your workshops is, was it cultural responsiveness?
I deal with culturally responsive teacher. Also, I deal with data-driven instruction. I also talk about using your particular local state assessment to match whatever you're doing at the state level. So there's a lot of different type of things that I do. I deal with Common Core standards, just everything that you need in order to become a quality teacher, or like I say, a quality principal.
What is culturally responsive teaching look like?
Well, I think that when you see it from the principal standpoint, it looks like how you just transform your school, how you do your morning announcements, how you greet the kids when they come to the school, how the different type of figures or pictures that you have through your hallway, the books that you give to the kids, how you conduct your lunchroom duty, how they walk in the hallway. From a principal standpoint, that's what it looks like. From the classroom standpoint, is how you interact with the kids. I have all my teachers, they do a call and response type of thing inside of the classroom. How do you have high expectations for the kids? Do you see themselves as doctors, lawyers, things of that nature? How do you code switch and how do kids code switch in the classroom? So I know I'm saying a lot, but those are the things that I deal with as it relates to culturally responsive teaching, because at the end of the day, we want to teach the kids based on their culture and where they're coming from. A lot of times, once again, we try to deprogram kids and say, hey, you've been living in this environment or you've been watching this. That's terrible. You need to adapt to this type of particular culture or how we teach. And what I say is that we need to bring their culture to the classroom, and then we need to meet them halfway and say, what you're doing at home is fine, but now we're going to code switch and we're going to do something different inside of this classroom. And then once you leave the classroom, then you can code switch and talk and act and do what you do at home.
So do you explicitly teach code switching, or is it more modeled?
I do a training with my teachers throughout the year, and we talk about code switching. We talk about if a kid says a different type of slang, we don't say that's bad vocabulary. We say, okay, that's vocabulary that's used at home. Now, what would be something that would be similar to something that you would use at school? So we're open to where they're coming from, but also with that, we understand that when it comes to standardized tests, interviewing for jobs, being able to articulate yourself, these are the things that you have to also have in your vocabulary to be able to be successful, in addition to what you're bringing from home.
I really like that. That's one of the skills, and I like that you're doing it explicitly. A lot of times, we're afraid to even broach those conversations as a school body. Maybe not individual teachers one to one, but kind of as a complete school unit. Not everybody's comfortable having that conversations, and it sounds like you've really built some staff competencies in that area.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, yes. A lot of times, and then that's part of the kind of the how you deal with your staff. I believe in dealing with the elephant in the room. Like, a lot of my students are African-American or Latino kids that's coming from inner city. So we do have those type of conversations. I do say, well, what is the best way? What are the best practices on how African-American or Latino students learn coming from inner city? Let's have a discussion on that. What does that look like? So when you have those discussions and when the kids come to the room, that gives the teachers five or six different strategies on how to deal with different things that's going to arise throughout a school year. Right. A lot of times we're scared to have those type of conversations, and consequently the teachers get in front of 25 kids and then they're set up for failure. So now the teachers are mad, so they end up quitting or retiring or whatever it may be. The kids are learning, parents are frustrated, and it's just a cycle that goes all over and over and over again.
From what you're saying, I'm surprised you have not been snatched up by somebody somewhere. You've been a principal for over 8 years, and it sounds like you've got your stuff nailed down. Is there a couple of pieces of advice that you would give to new principals just kind of entering the business?
Well, I I think the first thing is that find a mentor that you can talk to, or you can bring into your school to help with some type of professional development that has been successful over the years. That's the first thing. Second thing is that make sure, without a shadow of a doubt, that you know, understand, and you live by data. Data has to drive every decision that you make, to the point where you use data to even say, teachers, why are you having recess? What's the data saying about recess?
Mm-hmm.
Third thing is to make sure that you surround yourself with superstar experts in their field. Like for me, I have a dynamic curriculum specialist. She's been with me every step of the way. She's super, so I know that my weaknesses are her strengths. And not just my curriculum specialist, but my whole team, they're very good. So we kind of just grow from one another. So those would be the three things I would tell any new principal as they get into the field.
I'm writing those down. Data, support your own weaknesses. And what was that first one?
Is data, support your own weaknesses, and make sure you have a mentor. Get a good mentor that could come in and kind of train you. Mentorship.
Yep, and I think each of those pieces you kind of mentioned, having an expert in that field, so that idea of surrounding yourself with excellent people is only going to make you raise your game. So I really like those pieces of advice. Last question for this episode. What are two books that have had the greatest impact on you in terms of your principalship?
Well, I'm going to say not so much two books, but two individuals or authors that I have read multiple books that I would encourage anybody to read. The first one is a gentleman called Principal Cafele. And he deals with principal leadership and how that looks. So his name is Principal Cafele, Principal Burute Cafele, and he has 7 or 8 different books. The other person is Dr. Anthony Muhammad, and he deals with the transformational culture. So those two individuals, Anthony Muhammad and Principal Burute Cafele, are two just good people that I would recommend anybody to read and study, and you'll get a lot of insight.
Two great choices. I appreciate you taking the time, Mr. Hurt. People want to reach out to you and find out more about the services that you provide. Where should they go to find out more about your turnaround expertise?
No problem at all. Well, if anyone would like to learn more about the work that I do, they can reach me on my website. My website is www.shurtschoolturnaround.com. Once again, that's www.shurtschoolturnaround.com. Also, you can also email me at Sean, S-H-A-W-N, Hurt, H-U-R-T, 24@yahoo.com, or you can call me at 734-945-8498. Once again, 734-945-8498. Also, you can reach me on Facebook. I'm also on YouTube and also on LinkedIn. Just type in Sean Hurt and all of my information will come up.
All right, man. I really, really appreciate your time. This was a great, great learning experience for me. And I'm going to be calling you since you're in the city. I'd love to sit down and chat with you, man. Speaking of mentors, let me know if you got some time over the summer.
No, that won't be a problem. I just thank you for reaching out to me. I really love this podcast. And then, like I said, I'm here to help. I want to really just improve education across the world. And I'm reaching out to everybody. I want to just kind of just talk to everybody, because I believe that if we could just come together and use best practices in these schools throughout these districts, we will see student achievement just soar through the roof. And then we can produce these excellent scholars that I know that they're made to be.
All right, man. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Once again, that was elementary principal and turnaround expert Mr. Sean Hurt. A quick summary of some of his main points include: the schools that are doing well across the United States, even the world, are using data to drive instruction. We have to have high expectations for our students. A lot of times we feel like we have to lower our expectations because the students come from environments that aren't conducive to learning, and that's something that you should never do. And the final tip was kids are kids. We're going to deal with our mindset and how we view these kids, how we look at these kids, and how we're going to deliver instruction every day. Three pieces of advice he has for beginning principals include: find a mentor, make sure that you know and understand and live by the data, and surround yourself with superstar experts in their field. Finally, two authors that he recommends include Principal Kafele and Dr. Anthony Muhammad. If you are a principal, make sure that you check out the new grant scholarship available that honors the hard work you put in on a daily basis. K-12 principals, go to my website, theprincipalentrepreneur.com, and click on grant application. For more short articles and tips that support educational leaders, go over there again and check out my blog at theprincipalentrepreneur.com, as well as howtobeagreatprincipal.com. Both of those URLs go to the same spot. Check out my newest book, How to Be a Great Principal, and you can also download more podcasts here on Podomatic or iTunes. I have weekly episodes that usually come out Tuesday and Thursday, and Saturday, if I am lucky enough to get a principal who is not overly busy, I usually put those out on Saturdays. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, you can email me at jonathanroyce@theprincipalentrepreneur.com. Finally, I am part of a community of supportive principals. Join us at our private Facebook group. Just search The Principal Entrepreneur and you will find us there on Facebook. That is it for this episode. Thanks for listening to The Principal Entrepreneur.